Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's June 22nd, 2017 program, Predictive Scheduling. Is it right for Oregon? My name is Juan Carlos Valle, immediate past president. With now, I would like to ask you to help me welcome our new president, Sandra Bishop.
Thank you, Juan Carlos. Juan Carlos is a rather difficult act to follow. He's done a lot of work for City Club in the last year, and I want to also take the time to say we have a very active and engaged board, and it's the board members working together, 12-member board, that really makes City Club happen, and all the volunteers, so thank you. And our president for next year is Joel Corin, our president-elect. So now to our program for today. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We're a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member of City Club at citycluboforegon.org. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, HCSAW. HCSAW is committed to providing safe, affordable, and energy-efficient housing for low-income families, elderly citizens, and folks with disabilities. Today's program is coordinated by Joel and Paul Thomas. And I'd like to have Paul introduce our speakers. Paul Thomas.
This is the second program in a City Club series featuring topics on the intersection of the business, social, and technology worlds. This is in part an outgrowth of the City Club's new association with the Eugene Chamber of Commerce and other business entities. The third program in our series, it's called Brainwaves, Worms, and Detergent, from U of O Research to Thriving Businesses, will be held 2 weeks from today, and we hope that you can join us. I think you'll find it a fascinating program. We solicit ideas for future programs from the business and technology communities who are here today or who are listening on the radio. The suggestions can be posted at the City Club website at www.cityclubofeugene.org. Today we have two distinguished experts in the world of labor management relations who will explore the issues surrounding the predictive scheduling legislation which is currently pending in the Oregon legislature. Mike Nesbitt is president of the Papa's Group, which owns five Papa's restaurants in Oregon, having 250 non-union employees, many of whom are part-time. He serves as president of the Oregon Restaurant Association, and in that capacity is spending substantial time in Salem talking to legislators about how to modify the legislation we're talking about today so that it's more business-friendly. Mike started at Papa's Pizza part-time while he was in college. That led to full-time employment with Papa's for 17 years, at which time the previous owner retired. Immediately, Mike and some others bought the company, and he's been running it for the last 12 years. Our previously scheduled speaker, Kevin Billman, has had a last-minute medical emergency which prevents him from making a presentation. In his stead, we're fortunate to have Mike Salvaggio, who's been involved with molding public policy in Oregon for 15 years. He started his career as a staffer to several senators and then migrated to be the policy director for the Oregon State Treasury. He currently is a small business owner plus a contract lobbyist for several organizations, including the Audubon Society, the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriff Deputies, and the political party, the Oregon Working Families Party. By mutual agreement, Mike Nesbitt is going to speak first. Mike?
So I hate to get up here right away and start correcting Paul, but the Restaurant and Lodging Association, Jason Brandt, is actually the president and CEO of that. And I've been involved in some of the Restaurant and Lodging Association activities, and they, it was actually honored to be a part of their trip that went back to Washington, D.C. Early in March. And that was interesting for me because I'd never been to Washington, D.C. I don't do this. I've been doing pizzas for 43 years, and until paid sick leave came along, I'd never been involved in anything even close to political. My concern when we started talking about paid sick leave was that the government was starting to intrude into our business. And at some point or another, that intrusion becomes very intrusive. When I started out on the issue of sick leave, I was 110% opposed to any paid sick leave for any of my employees. We provided it to who we thought we needed to provide it to, and government shouldn't be telling us anything different. By the time I got through into the debate in Salem, those views had changed, and I could see that there was a need for some level of paid sick leave for those who are working full-time or near full-time. So I would have proposed 25 hours and up, something like that. Unfortunately, there was no willingness to compromise, and so what I end up with is my mostly part-time staff, many of whom are high school and college-age kids, who I'm supposed to be trying to train to be good citizens and good employees moving forward. Tools have been taken out of my hand, and I can't do that. In the past year, we've had to fire more employees for calling in sick, and their friends rat them out, and there they are on Snapchat, out at the lake or out drinking or something else. In the past, we didn't have to do that. We could counsel them. We could maybe suspend them for a week. We could do something to mold them the way that you would expect an employee to be molded as they're learning how to be an employee. Now, though, they're stealing from us. And that's with the bottom line. If they call in sick and we pay them paid sick leave and they aren't actually sick, they're stealing from us, and we don't tolerate theft. So it's put us into a whole different ball game when we're dealing with that. And this predictive scheduling is another step in that direction. There are many things in the predictive scheduling bill, SB 828, that are good. Clopins, where somebody closes, get out there at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, has to come back, is required to come back at 6 o'clock in the morning, that's crazy. Nobody should be forced to do that. And I would support that legislation against that. There's parts of this legislation which deal with on-call scheduling. We don't do on-call scheduling, never have, I guess. There are businesses who do it, but I don't know who they are. But they're out there. And so they essentially say, well, you've got to be available to work or you'll be fired, but we're not going to clock you in until we need you. That, too, is crazy. And I would absolutely support legislation against that. Where I have problems is when we start talking about requiring a two-week schedule for our employees. Again, I've got a lot of high school and college-age kids. Many of you probably have high school and college-age kids or grandkids. They don't know what they're doing tomorrow, let alone 2 weeks from now. Well, now we're able to accommodate that. If this bill were to pass, that's, again, taken out of our hands. We post that schedule 2 weeks in advance, and it's up to them to get somebody to cover for them. If we cover for them, if we get involved in the process, as we do now, all of a sudden, the person that we found to cover that shift is getting paid time and a half. That's crazy. We can't afford to do that. If an employee calls in sick, any employee that we call in to cover it, even an employee who wants to cover the shift, is going to get paid time and a half. If we are put in the position of having to reduce hours because of or increase hours because maybe the Ducks are playing at 7 o'clock in the afternoon instead of 1 o'clock. Well, it's a lot busier at 7 o'clock, so I need to bring more people in to cover those shifts. Now every one of those people that I would bring in, I've got to pay time and a half. It's not fair to businesses. And there are compromises. And that's where my biggest frustration, and not to sound partisan, but when the Oregon legislature doesn't really often want to compromise on a lot of this stuff. And that's frustrating for me, because there are compromises, even on the two-week scheduling. Okay? The purported reason for the two-week scheduling, the one that I've heard most often, was that you need to be able to provide predictive scheduling for the single mother who has to plan childcare in advance. Makes sense to me. It makes sense for most parents. But why don't we address that? Why doesn't the legislature pass a bill saying that every employee in this state may ask for and receive a two-week schedule in advance, but leave it up to the employees? Don't force everybody to do it. The one-size-fits-all does not achieve the goals that they're trying to achieve. And I passed out some handouts, and you can take them for what they're worth. I mean, too often these come from the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and they're commissioned by people that have an agenda. But there are statistics in there that are important, and some of those statistics show that well over 60% of employees are happy with the way scheduling is done now. Why change that? Why not address the concerns that employees have who actually have valid concerns? There's a lot of moving parts to this bill, but to me, those are the key ones. When you start forcing employees and businesses to schedule 2 weeks in advance, then you create problems for both the employees and the business. We have two employee meetings every year at each of our stores. And this spring, I was able to bring up this very specific legislation with my employees. And at the end of the meeting, I asked by a show of hands, how many would like to have a two-week schedule posted? Nobody raised their hand. Maybe they were afraid to, but I don't think I'm that intimidating to the employees. So they were given the opportunity to answer honestly. And I have received more comments from employees on this single issue than anything in the past. Minimum wage, paid sick leave, any of the legislation that's been brought up. This has generated more interest in trying to get it corralled in some way than anything else. I have employees, 16-year-old, I had seven high school and college age students who on their own time went to Portland with me to testify against this bill. Those were all from the Springfield Parlor. Now, if you don't think it isn't hard to try to get kids to go up and do something like that, and unfortunately, one of them was allowed to testify because they ran out of time. But it's a reality that they were willing to do that because they don't see this as being good for them. Are there people who would benefit? There's going to be people in any legislation that benefit from just about anything you pass. But there will be negative consequences for far more employees than those that you're going to help. And if there's those who do need help, let's address those individuals. Let's compromise. Let's get back to where we can sit across from one another and have a dialogue, just as I did with a couple of Democratic House representatives over this past month. I had an opportunity to sit down with them. Do we agree on everything? Absolutely not. But we could see where there were ways that we could compromise on SB 828. And I think both of them would be willing to make those compromises. Whether it'll happen or not, I don't know. But if this bill does pass, it's going to create chaos, at least in the restaurant industry. And that's not a good thing. That's all I got. Thank you for your time.
Hello, Michael Salvaggio here. I'm here on behalf of the Working Families Party. And, I'm a contract lobbyist, so when they first came to me late last year and they said, hey, Mike, we've worked with you before. How do you feel about helping us out on this workforce scheduling issue? Well, I'm a small business owner too, so at first I thought, ooh, gosh, let me look at that. Let me see if it's something I want to help out on. And I read through the bill that they had, and I said, I'm doing most of this already. We have few employees on off years, but sometimes we put a lot of employees on seasonal work, and, you know, giving them a schedule in advance, allowing them the flexibility that they need to change that at their discretion and mine, letting them know if there is going to be a long shift, a short shift, allowing for shift swaps. We do that already. And if there was a time when someone came in and we just didn't have a shift for them and that was our fault, you know, we'd pay them for their time and pay them for their gas. So I said, heck yeah, sign me up. This sounds like a great policy. And it was late last year, except the policy had already been discussed in work group for months before that. And I do wish that some of the industry groups had stayed at that table, because I do think that the resulting bill as introduced would have been a lot more palatable, a lot more to the center. As some of those groups walked away from the table, we did the best we could to talk not only to Democrats but also to Republicans and get a bipartisan bill put together for the beginning of session. And as we're moving through the process, there is compromise going on, there are negotiations, and we do expect the final result to look a little different. But the core reason that we're putting this up, I think, is we're not just looking at it from the perspective of workers that would benefit. I think that we need to look at this from the perspective of the entire state, because as a state, we have set certain priorities that I think we can all agree on. One of those priorities is we think that employees should be able to go to school and improve themselves and take classes and go for that associate's degree or go for that bachelor's degree. We think that employees should be able to plan their personal finances so that they can budget and save and know that they're going to be able to make rent month to month. These are things that affect the state as a whole. It matters to you whether your neighbors are able to make rent. It matters to you and all of us whether someone is able to improve themselves through an additional degree. And not just in a esoteric sense, but in a financial sense too. Moving someone from a high school diploma to a bachelor's degree saves taxpayers around $5,000 a year. That's an interest to all of us. But those things can't happen if employees don't know their schedule in advance. But we're not saying that schedules need to be chiseled away in stone and then unchangeable. We've worked very, very hard, and I think if you read Section 7 of the current bill or Section 10 of the introduced bill, you'll see that what we're trying to do is create a situation of flexibility where right now employees, if they don't show up for a shift, they can get penalized. They don't always get penalized, but they can get penalized. But if an employer drops a shift, there's no penalty there. So what we're trying to do is add some more stability to that that situation. And when we began drafting out what this was going to look like, we didn't just want to shoot from the hip. We said, let's figure out where the problems are, and let's try to get this as narrow as reasonable. And so we looked at this study that was put out by Professor Mary King at the Portland State University. And it was a very, very broad-based examination of a lot of workers and a lot of different types of employers. And what we found out is that most of the employers in the state are good actors. Mr. Nesbitt's a great actor. I wish that every business owner in the state had his values. But we also found that in certain sectors and in certain sizes of businesses, particularly large businesses in retail, hospitality, and food service, there were patterns of difficulties and problems with employees. And so we said, let's draft this bill so that we're addressing where we need to address. The initial version of the bill cast a bit of a wider net, but if you look at the amended version, I think you'll see that we've already begun taking that down. And so we said, and the way that the current bill is written, first of all, you got to have more than 100 employees in the state for this to apply to you. Second, you have to be in one of those three industries, hospitality, retail, or food service. Second, we said for those businesses, there's going to be certain scheduling requirements. First is called a good faith estimate. When an employee is hired, we want the businesses to give their best guess of exactly what this job is going to entail. Because we've heard a lot of stories about employees who say, you know, I had an option of two jobs. One of them said it was only 20 hours a week, but I could really use the 30-hour week job. But it turns out that those 30 hours, 20 of them were on call. So they didn't know if they were going to actually get 30 hours worth of a paycheck each week. And that meant that each week they didn't know if they were going to be able to make rent. They also didn't know if they were going to be able to take classes at night. So I've got a employee that we work with named Haley, who has to sit by the phone for a couple hours every night wondering if she's going to get called into work or not. She doesn't get to go out with her friends. She doesn't get to schedule other things. She just has to wait and see if she gets that call or not. If she doesn't get it, then she doesn't have a paycheck for that day. Secondly, the actual 2 weeks advance notice. Now, again, like I said, this is not an advance notice that gets chiseled in stone. This is 2 weeks where the employer says, here's what your schedule is going to look like. Now, also, we've written in certain exemptions to that. If there's a shift swap, then great. You can swap shifts so long as it's within your employer's shift swap policies. The employer can say, well, sorry, we don't allow shift swaps. Secondly, employee requests. If the employee goes to the employer and says, hey, I'd like to pick up an extra shift, or I'd like to drop this shift, and the employer is fine with that, great. More power to you. There's an exemption for extra closing time. Sometimes it takes a little more time in the evening to close down. There's an exemption for natural disasters, emergencies, utility outages. There's exemptions for disciplinary reasons. And so we've tried to make this as flexible as possible without sacrificing the core values that we're trying to get at. The we also, as Ms. Nesbitt mentioned, there's clopening policies, and clopening means that you're closing and opening back-to-back. And this is something that that we hear about more on large retailers. But we feel that everyone should get 10 hours of rest, except if, again, we want there to be flexibility. So if an employee says, and there are employees that have told us, I really like working the clopenings. I think it's great. I don't need a lot of sleep at night. You know, I'm 20 years old and full of energy. Great. Go for that shift. If they're willing to work it, then they can work it. But they can't be forced to work it is our point. And in the particular situation where someone is subject to that predictability pay, and an employer says, you know, gosh, I'm really sorry, but there is some kind of a rush, or there is some kind of emergency situation, and I got to call you in. They don't get time and a half. They get plus 1 hour added to their schedule for that whole shift. And if you've got to send an employee away that was on the schedule, and you say, I'm sorry to put you on the schedule, but I know you were going to work 8 hours, but we only have 4 hours of work for you. That last 4 hours of work that they were counting on, they're going to get paid out for half that, not the whole time. And that actually mirrors a policy that was statewide, applying to every employer in the state from 1971 to 1986, that was administrative rules sent down by Boley. So we know that it can exist in the state of Oregon. And so one of the other things that we've worked in here is that right now the current bill says this would preempt local policies in perpetuity, meaning that the city of Eugene couldn't say, oh, and by the way, we're going to add on to those penalties. Now, this was a tough discussion to have. I'm not super thrilled about that concession, but I point it out to illustrate the fact that there are discussions happening. There are people coming together from both sides and turning this bill into something that that people from both both opponents and proponents can get behind. That doesn't mean that I'm going to like every single piece in the bill. It doesn't mean that restaurant owners are going to like every single piece in the bill. But what we do hope it means is that it creates an environment where we do have more predictable salaries for workers. We do have workers that are more free and able to manage their personal lives, strengthen their family units, go to school, take a second job, and do that with the some sort of assurance that that's not going to imperil their paycheck or their very job. Because, and I'll just add one last thing. When we look at this policy as a necessity for the greater community, I think that there are a lot of businesses out there that respect that and understand that, and we've heard from a number of them. New Seasons Market has endorsed the bill. The Main Street Alliance and their members have endorsed the bill. And even when you look at this policy from the perspective of the Council of State Chambers of Commerce, they polled their members and they said, what do you guys think about predictable scheduling policies, specifically limiting on-call pay and giving advance notice of schedule? This is the Council of State Chambers of Commerce. 78% of their members were in support, 11 were opposed. So I think that there is an acknowledgement that there is something that needs to change, not just for the case of one employee or here or there, but because we have an interest, all of us, in creating a state where we do have our workforce able to go to college, where we do have our workforce able to plan for their personal finances, and we do have our workforce able to strengthen those family units. And that's what this bill is trying to get to. And so I know that there's some issues to work out, and we are working through a lot of those questions and discussions. I think what we end up with is going to be stronger for those discussions, and I do hope that we get a bill because, like I said, this is something that even if you're not an hourly employee, you're going to feel it one way or another. Thank you.
Thank you to Mike Nesbitt and Mike Salvaggio. Thank you. So our first questioner today is Marcus Widener. It's an honor to have Marcus here today. Marcus is an associate professor emeritus at the University of Oregon. Marcus has been a labor educator for 40 years. Many of us have seen his work over the years. He received degrees from Antioch College and the University of Massachusetts, and he retired in 2013 from the faculty, I always say running, the U of O Center for Labor Education and Research. Professor Widener's main teaching interests have been labor history, collective bargaining, labor law, and workplace dispute resolution. His published research includes works on the history of Oregon's wood products unions and the development of collective bargaining in Oregon's public sector. Marcus has really seen a lot of changes over the years in the labor movements. And so we're glad to have him here today to ask the first question of our two speakers. And the far mic, thanks.
Thank you for this opportunity. I think the competitiveness of Oregon's service economy has led to this situation where employers are using computer algorithms to regulate the scheduling of their workers most efficiently. Now, as we've heard, some workers find flexibility in scheduling a welcome thing, but it can also result in unpredictability for people, including short and frequent notice of changes, variable shift lengths, and employers being on call for long periods of time. So my question is, are these changes just a part of the new economy that we have to get used to? Do they create more flexibility for everyone? And finally, is legislation the best mechanism to give workers more control over their work while simultaneously recognizing the need for employers to manage their bottom line?
We are in a position where we do schedule a week in advance. We aren't penalized if we have to make schedule changes to that, but we do accommodate our employees, so it's a mutual benefit to everybody. We know who wants more hours. They'll put notes up there. The reality for a business, though, is that if you start penalizing us for what we would do under normal circumstances and as a good business operations, then it becomes detrimental to us and detrimental to the employees. Is it a factor for the way that business is now and is going to be in the future? I can't answer that except to say the unfortunate reality of the increasing cost of labor is that many businesses are replacing employees with robots. We aren't, don't plan to, but we didn't 5 years ago, we had no online ordering. Now we do. Online ordering takes a counter person out of the kitchen and saves us hours. As labor becomes more expensive, we have to find ways to make efficiencies. And that's the future, in my opinion, of food service and retail. You're going to find more and more people replaced by something or someone that doesn't cost as much. And that's not good for anybody.
So I think Mr. Nesbitt's on the right track, and if the future of employment is robots doing the work, I want Oregonians to have the jobs designing and building those robots. And that's not going to happen if they don't have the ability to go to school while they're working. So we mentioned scheduling software and how that's kind of turning into the new normal. And you know, this measure is not meant to be a windfall for employees. When we're talking about 1 hour of predictability pay onto the schedule for bringing a worker in, that's not meant to say, well, tough nuts, you got called in, but, you know, hey, here's $15. That's fantastic, right? That's really meant to be kind of more felt on the employer side so that they have less of an incentive to move their schedule like that. And when we see employers more relying on automatic scheduling technology, we do fully expect the technology to catch up to the policy. And to me, that's the role of legislation, is not to get in there and have the legislature look at the two-week schedule and say, no, 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 move Mary to Monday and then move Phil to Thursday. The point to me is to create a situation where the incentives are aligned with the outcomes that we want to see as a society. And if the outcomes we want to see are employees able to go to school, able to plan for their family lives, able to plan for their personal finances, then we need to make a situation in which that scheduling software and those policies in the new normal are incentivized towards that stability. And so that's really what we're creating here with this legislation, is a set of incentives to get at the outcomes we want. We're not trying to create the outcomes out of whole cloth here. So that's what I see the role as.
Thank you. So now we'll take a break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table, and those members in the seats as well are certainly welcome to ask questions. We'll return after the break with audience questions. Remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask the questions at the microphone. Thank you.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the June 2nd City Club program. Predictive scheduling, is it right for Oregon? Support for the City Club of Eugene is from members and sponsors, including Hearing Associates, offering a full range of diagnostic and preventative hearing healthcare professional services, including diagnostic audiological evaluations, hearing aid fittings, and rehabilitative counseling. And we also thank KLCC 89.7 FM, NPR for Oregonians. We also offer a special note of thanks to KPFF Consulting Engineers for their in-kind donation for the past 8 years, providing office space for City Club of Eugene. Thank you for your generosity and service to the community, and we wish the KPFF company well as they continue to grow. The City Club's new office space is being donated by Dot Dotson's Photography. The City Club offers our gratitude for that. Thank you. And now to member questions. And please keep your questions as questions, not long statements. So thank you very much. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hi, Sandy Erickson, City Club member. I hope I get this out right, but obviously many of the businesses that employ flexible scheduled workers are owned and operated by men, as are many of the laws in the legislature and so on that are formed around that system. And yet I hear very little concern, not very much information in the studies that seem to have been done, about the effects of children who are those of single mothers, especially since over half of the jobs that are employed flexible workers are seem to be, to me, ones that I've identified as often women-dominated.
Sandy, is there a question?
There's a
okay.
question.
Okay.
And 30% have children at home. So the question is, why doesn't the system care about what happens to the children of single mothers because they must work in flexible jobs, especially in a country that does not have any organized child care system?
This is part of the frustration I feel, too.
Could you introduce yourself for the radio?
I'm Mike Nesbitt.
Thanks, Mike.
Papa's Pizza. Got to get the plug in. That's where we go back to the compromise that I was talking about earlier, because I do recognize that single mothers, parents, whether they're single or not, face frustrations in trying to schedule ahead of time. So why not take this bill and tailor it towards those parents, single parents, not single parents, parents, period, and allow them to request a schedule 2 weeks in advance? Because I think that then would address that concern and make it easier for them to make that schedule. The one size fits all, my concern is, you're penalizing people to whom that is not a concern. And I have a supervisor at our Springfield store who wrote emails to our legislators against this, and she is a single mother. But she likes the flexibility because it allows her to work her schedule around better for her and her son. And she told me that she was not in favor of this legislation. So it can work both ways. But I think when you talk about a compromise, addressing that very issue, I think, is a very important issue. And I would fully support that.
Thank you. We do have a lot of questions, so if you keep it short.
I'll keep it short. Again, Mike Silvaggio here for Oregon Working Families. And we care very much about that issue, and the legislation is not meant to be an end-all for all of the issues that that we're going to encounter. But we do feel that this is going to make it a lot easier for families of any size and any shape to be able to plan prospectively for things like childcare, to know that there's going to be a stable paycheck coming in. And if you are on call and don't get called in, or if you have your shift scheduled, you know, a lot of people, if they have their shift scheduled, they've already planned for childcare. They've already paid for childcare. And so that's one of the goals of this bill, is to make that a little easier and make that a little bit more stable. Is it going to solve 100% of those issues? It's not. But I think it's going to be several steps in the right direction.
Linda Jensen, City Club member. My question is for Mike. I think often with this sort of legislation comes up, the picture is kind of painted of an America in the past where the people affected by this kind of job are high school students that are just trying to earn some extra money and want more flexibility. But do you have any statistics on who's actually affected by this? Because I suspect there are a lot more people who need to support families and stuff that are actually affected by this legislation. Did you have kind of, can you paint a picture of sort of the majority of the people affected?
Mike, would you introduce yourself?
Sure. Mike Silvaggio again. So I'm afraid that I don't have as good numbers as I could. I'm sure that Kevin knows them by heart. But I do know that I think 20% of the workers in the state across the board are part-time hourly. And so when we look at that study that's been done by Dr. Mary King, I believe that she has done a very broad look at different age groups, different families in different financial situations. I'm afraid that I'm not going to have a very precise answer for you just filling in today, but I would go to that Mary King report.
Hi, Mary Layton, City Club member. On our table's question has to do with if not this, then what? I was thinking, we were all grateful, like my two kids started work in a pizza parlor and when they were 14. So pizza's like in the family business in a lot of us. But I was thinking about my son who grew up to be a part-time military member and how often he felt at least subtly discouraged from pursuing employment in certain agencies because his military duties would interfere with reliability. And women, a lot of people in this room have probably experienced the question, how soon do you expect to have children or how are you going to have your children taken care of? So the issue is all of us in self-interest will take care of the health of our own business and we will sometimes fall short of virtue. And so the law is kind of helping us raise the floor a little bit on self-interest so we're fair. How does one assure fairness so that women with children or families of any kind or irregularities in anybody's life would not pose an obstacle to employment if we're operating on a kind of ad hoc basis? So you would want to be nice, but maybe you can't afford to be nice this year because profits are not that great. I'm just trying to figure out, absent law, what would you do? How would you handle that as an owner?
From my point of view, so much of what we see debated in the legislature could be handled, could be fixed if we're willing to have an honest debate and willing to make compromise. And that's where we fall down because, as I've said repeatedly, I see a perfectly valid way to compromise on this two-week schedule. You make that available. I mean, Boley writes laws all the time, regulations that we have to follow. I mean, I know very well. And if there was a law passed by the legislature that said every parent, not single parent, whatever, every parent in this state has the right to ask for a two-week schedule, that solves many of the problems without infringing on the other employees. And to me, that just makes sense.
So I'll be brief to kind of watch the clock, but you've asked a question that gets at some very, very deep issues of political and governmental philosophy. Because, you know, I think it was one of the Federalist Papers where they said, well, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. And, you know, like I said, business owners like Mike here are not the ones that we're worried about. We don't have stop signs out there for the safe drivers. We have stop signs out there for the drivers that won't stop at an intersection. And so the question really is, generally, how as a society do we make sure that the potential bad actors are acting in that greater interest of all of us? And so going back to that, you know, philosophical answer, it depends on your view of what government means. And like I said, I don't think the government means getting into micromanaging, you know, exactly who's on what shift. But I do think that it's reasonable to say we're going to create a situation where there are incentives that kind of tip the playing field towards fairness when it's not, or maybe reset the playing field so that it's fair. We've all been in a situation where, you know, we buy a plane ticket and we have to change our reservation, and then no, it's charged $100 to us. But when the airline changes their reservation, they don't have to pay us, right? Well, a lot of employees are facing that in their workplaces. They miss a shift, you know, they could be fired or disciplined, but if the shift gets changed on them, you know, there's no penalty there. And so I think that what we need to see is government not not really get into people's faces to the point where they're micromanaging, but say, we're going to tip that playing field back towards fairness.
Thank you. It turns out we have a little bit more time than I thought, so no need to rush. So go ahead.
I can talk forever. Bob Cassidy, City Club member.
No, not you, the answers. No, sorry.
Mike, I strongly, as a previous business owner in the food industry, strongly agree with your opinion about one size fits all being really bad. I don't trust the wisdom of the legislature to be able to craft such things with the businesses that are so diverse, so different. My concern is that there are some things that are moral issues that need the legislation, minimum wage being one of them. When I was in business, the minimum wage was immoral, $4.25 an hour. And I was paying more than this and doing a lot of other benefits, but my competition was paying at $4.25. And I found that difficult to be able to raise to the wages to what they should be. So I pushed very strongly for that, even though the Chamber of Commerce and the Restaurant Association was fighting that. My question is, what would happen if businesses did, say like Nikasi did, when they started, they had their public relations person coming and telling us how they were going to treat their employees. And I was impressed. I've been drinking Nikasi ever since. What about businesses advertising themselves like, we pay $15 minimum wage an hour as an incentive for people to come there? My business went way up when I was pushing this minimum wage for my business. It just really expanded an awful lot. People wanted to go to a place where they were taking care of their employees. And we had that reputation. I didn't have to advertise.
Thank you, Bob. That's a good question, gentlemen.
Thank you, Bob. I think too often it's easy to forget that there's a wide range of businesses out there. And there are some businesses like Nikasi where perhaps they can push, I don't want to call them more socially acceptable employment practices, but that's kind of what it boils down to. On the other hand, you have the reality of fast food. And the reality of fast food is that it's not highly trained workers. It's not steady workers. We do better than most by a long shot. I mean, most of my employees, you're looking at 2 to 5 years that they've been with us, and my managers, good grief, I have other managers who've been with us for 30, 35 years. So we do retain our people, but you can't, just as we can't have a one-size-fits-all predictive scheduling bill, in my opinion, I don't think that you can have necessarily all businesses be expected to conform to the same model when it comes to what you pay, what your benefits are, what you can afford. It has to be tailored to the business itself. And then we live with the consequences. But we pay back in other ways. And I'm sure that most everybody in this room has been to a fundraiser at Papa's Pizza. That's how we give back to the community. And that's very important to us. And that's $250,000 a year that we do that. But we're recognizing that some of our employees are not going to be with us for the rest of their lives. It's just a fact. Sometimes they'll be with us for 3 weeks or less. So we have to tailor our business to our employees and try to make it work for them. And each business is going to have a different model for that.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. My name is John Belcher, and I'm a City Club member since 1999. A couple of questions for you. First, what is the numbers of the bills? What are their status, and what is their likelihood of passing? And both of you have said that there are things that you think could be done to these bills to make them better. Could each of you give us 3 examples? Thank you.
Good question. Who would like to take that one on first?
So I'll just give a brief overview of where the
introduce yourself. So
sorry, Mike Salvaggio again. I'm going to give you a brief overview of where the bills are. Now, the bill that I think most of the efforts are being focused on is Senate Bill 828. Now, if you look that up, it's going to say Senate Bill 828-A. That means that it's already been amended once. That has currently been passed out of the Senate Workforce Committee on a bipartisan vote and is now sitting in the Senate Rules Committee. Now, the Rules Committee is not subject to deadlines that you may have heard about session, except that it's got to pop out by at the very, very latest when the legislature wraps up business and gavels to go home. So that gives a little bit of flexibility there, and I know that I think that's where it's going to sit until we have some more direction worked out on that. There is also a House bill, House Bill 2193, that has also been amended once. It passed out of the House Workforce Committee, I'm sorry, the House Business and Labor Committee, without recommendation into the House Rules Committee, and that's where it sits to this day. I don't expect that we're going to be doing any work on that, considering that the efforts seem to be focused on the Senate bill. So that's where the legislation is, and it's and then your question was, what are three examples of making the bill better? I'll just say I may not come up with three precisely because, you know, when you are discussing and negotiating a bill, it's all hydraulics. So I don't want to sit up here and say, here's three things that I'll do, and then, but I'd probably need six other things or maybe another thing over on the other side of the bill. But I will say this. We've been making some really good progress looking at how we kind of cast that wide net. And like I said, this bill had provisions that applied to every employer in the state when it was first introduced in January. We've narrowed that down to problem sectors and certain sizes. I do expect that we're going to have some more discussions on narrowing that exactly to who we're looking at affecting. And so I'll just leave that deliciously ambiguous and, you know, stay tuned.
Mike, did you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. As far as the three things, Mike Nesbitt with Papa's Pizza. I've already talked about one, and it's very important to me. I mean, if you can take the two-week schedule in advance and make that apply to the people it's really intended to apply to, that it's really going to help, I'd be all in favor of that. We wouldn't have any problem with that. I don't think most businesses would. Any penalty that penalizes a business for the reality of the business world is not good, in my opinion, because it also penalizes the employees. It disincentivizes us to replace a sick worker if we're going to be penalized for that, or if our business is not as busy as we'd anticipated, if a party doesn't show up that we'd scheduled for, well, we have to do something. We can't operate on charity, so we have to do something, and part of that is going to mean that the employees will get their hours. We have our own policy requiring employees to work a substantial portion of their shift, but I'm not going to keep them there for 3 hours standing around doing nothing. It makes no sense. But we would be penalized if we didn't do that, as I understand the bill. So those are a couple of things that really impact us. I think strengthening the clopen and strengthening the requirement that employees not be on call, I see no sense in that. That is, I've told employees who told me about it happening at other places of business, you need to go to Boley because this is wrong. And I would support whatever they come up with to deal with on-call scheduling.
Great, thank you. We have time for one more question, I think. Go ahead, Ruth.
Ruth Daimler, City Club member. I have a question. How can an employer not favor the people who have the fewest benefits? For instance, you suggested that Mike Nesbitt, it seems like I'd love my grandkids to come work for you, but anyway, how could you consider a group of your employees getting benefits, such as the parent benefit that you spoke about, and not having the rest of them get that benefit? Wouldn't you then, when you're choosing employees, choose only those that don't have benefits?
Mike Nesbitt again, Papa's Pizza. There's always going to be a challenge when you start making exclusions for any single employee or group of employees. But we also have to face realities of what we have to fill. And there are positions that we need to fill. Quite often those will be day positions. A lot of our younger people, they go to school. They can't work day shifts. So a lot of times we choose to hire parents, mothers, dads, whatever, because they have the ability to come in and work at the pizza parlor. we have different rules for different employees already. So it's not as if it's an impossible thing to deal with. I mean, our drivers operate under different rules for drug testing, for instance, than our other hourly employees. So we do have ways of working around that, and employees will understand as long as it makes sense.
Thank you. We have time for one more quick question.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some time. Let's talk for a second about the mechanics of bills going through the legislature. I'm moving away from the content of the bills and the policy to the mechanics. I know that SB 828, I've been monitoring it, has had lots of amendments and so on. Could you pick one issue where there's been a substantial change in the legislation so far, and just kind of talk about how that came into being? How did that actually happen? And hopefully you're going to have a happy story about management labor cooperation here.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of happy stories about, I'm sorry, Mike Salvaggio here again. There are a lot of good stories about management and labor cooperation. You know, the lobby in the building, they all have to kind of sit in the room in the basement in the Capitol building, and so we all get together and joke and whatnot. And so when the bill was first introduced, there was a broad provision about access to hours, which said that any employee that wanted additional shifts needed to be given those. You know, that was ultimately dropped. That was a very involved discussion between the proponents and opponents of the bill, and at the end of the day, we decided that it just didn't fit. It just didn't fit with the legislation that we were trying to push forward. There were other provisions that were ultimately dropped. Some that were added, and I'm trying to think of examples on the fly, and it's surprisingly difficult. But if you go to OLIS, the Oregon Legislative Information System, and search for SB 828, you're going to be able to see a list of all the amendments, all the different versions that we've gone through. But at the end of the day, like I said, this is a collaborative process. And once I think we get into that building, there's a lot of interests on either side that are able to sit down at a table together and as professionals and as friends say, I don't necessarily agree with you, but we're gonna work this out. And I really, really appreciate that, because you know, at the end of the day, if that's not happening in the Capitol building, then what's the point?
Thank you. Before we thank our guests today, there are a few quick announcements. The City Club appreciates our sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, Hearing Associates, and KLCC 89.7 FM. An additional thank you to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m., and the Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. Next week's program is What is Middle Missing Housing, and Is It Missing in Eugene? Josh Scove will explain the issue, the challenges, and suggest the steps to take to provide the type of housing that is needed. And please join us on Wednesday, June 14th, for the City Spring fundraiser, The Berry and Bubbly. This is an evening of music, organic strawberries and shortcake, and other desserts and local libations. It'll be held at the Sweet Cheeks Winery Tasting Room at the 5th Street Public Market. So look forward to seeing you all there. Bring your friends. All non-City Club member guests will be able to apply their registration toward a new City Club membership. More information can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's give a big thank you and round of applause to Mike Nesbitt and Mike Salvaggio. Thank you very much. Thank you. That concludes today's program.